Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 92-year-old ex-prisoner of war, Sam Banuelos of Fresno, California. Originally from nearby Madera, he started working in the San Joaquin Valley's fertile fields at age 9. He never went to high school because his family of 12 needed him to work, especially as the oldest of those 10 children. But in 1950, Uncle Sam said, "You need to come work for me." And soon, Sam was headed to Korea with the 3rd Infantry Division. Captured in an ambush in August 1951, he would spend the next 2 years in captivity. Right before we left off, Sam clued us into the unique way in which his family learned of his fate.
So from August to December, your family doesn't know if you're alive or dead. And then your brother back here in California is watching television, and they have a list scrolling on the screen of...
I think that's what he has. That's the year that the list of the news. When he was watching the news, they heard the list of the people that had been caught, mm-hmm. You know, had become prisoners. It was a trying time.
And, you know, most of the Korean War veterans I've spoken to who ended up over there, if they spent a winter there, that was very different from the guys who didn't have to spend a winter there. And you're spending a couple of them as a prisoner. Was that challenging?
Well, yes. Let's see, in the first winter, you see, we moved in the stages. Every so many weeks, we get moved. But then we got to the camp. When we were reached the camp, it was already, the next day it snowed. It was very cold on the way over. On the way over, one of the camps where we stopped, they took 23 of us, put in a small pickup, and 15 of us crammed like sardines. We driven over to this place and to a mining camp. There was a mining camp. Yes, but in the wintertime, when we got there to the camp, to the main camp, camp number one, I think it is, you know, it was the next day it snowed. You know, it was real cold on the way over.
Had you ever been in the snow before?
No, I never had been in the snow. Never had been in the snow. My weapon was, they had some buildings, you know, where we were able to, you know, just relax and rest, you know, until they finished in the camp.
And what else did your captors make you do? Did you have work you had to do during the day?
Yes, in the wintertime, when there was heavy snow, we had to clean the snow in the camp, you know, sweep up the snow. We didn't make way for it. We could move around. You know, most of the day, just stay inside a building, just telling stories or reading paper, or you know, really pass the time away that way. Or just talking to the other guys, that's about it. Yeah, but it's a waste of time.
Well, I was actually curious about that. You know, your fellow prisoners, how much those guys came to mean to you, what they did for you to help you survive.
Well, I was an anti-soldier with those guys, just... They had different lifestyles, you know, what they spoke and what they did, you know. And I was more a loner, you know, myself, you know. And I would get a book, you know, read or get the newspapers, and that's about how I keep busy that way.
And, you know, we mentioned the snow, and you'd never dealt with snow in Madera or Fresno. No. And here you are, a prisoner in Korea in that cold. And
we were able to move around. You know, we had to clean the snow. And then in the springtime is when we had to go and bring lumber and wood for the kitchen. You know, they had a kitchen. And because they had the system where they had a kitchen. The kitchen was in the one end, and they had, the flumes, you know, the underneath the floor, the trenches, about that wide. Mm-hmm. And that would be the heat from the kitchen, be the heat to the end of the building. And then, you know, then we use the heat that way. They had rice mats for covering the floor. You know, so that kept the place warm a little bit. But it was really just nothing to do. I didn't get the effect of the cold that much. You know, we were in a building. We were in a building that had that warmth, you know, in the wintertime. But I didn't get that cold that much.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the snow and the cold has something to do with your Purple Heart, doesn't it?
I never did get a Purple Heart. It was a bullet wound on the toe.
You got a bullet wound in the toe? Oh, here we go. Okay, so this is what we're talking about. How did that happen the day you were captured?
The day I was captured, yes. Uh-huh.
That was kind of an important detail we left out, wasn't it?
The guy was aiming my back, and he missed me and hit me in the toe. Because we got fired on. Right.
So that whole time that you're marching, that you're walking, that you're running, you even said, your toe is hurting and bleeding?
Yeah, I didn't know that until I took my shoe off. I felt something warm in the blood, you know. When I took my shoe off, it was bloody, so I had to go barefoot, you can't stop. But we kept on going. And
did that heal up after a while, or is that something that bothered you for a long time?
Yeah. No, it healed up after a while. We had to cross rivers also. And that was around the month of October, and the water was very cold. It was very cold. And we had to cross rivers, and it felt like they cut my legs off. It was that cold, so. But you kept on going. We had to keep on going.
Yeah.
There was no choice.
You say that kept on going. That's always something that's fascinated me with the prisoners of war I've had the privilege of meeting. I always think about the uncertainty. Because nobody tells you, like most of us in our life, right? We have deadlines, we have targets. Mm-hmm. Hey, by this date, we know we'll do this. But this was indefinite. You didn't know how long you were going to be a prisoner. How did you handle that? How did you come to grips with that mentally or psychologically or emotionally?
Well, as I explained, I come from an environment where we obey authority. We just follow the orders. We have no choice. Just keep on going, so... And stop and cry, just kept on going as we were told to go, until we reached that point. We went to that camp. The camp was a different lifestyle. It was a lot of guys there. They were about, when we got to the camp, I think they were around, somewhere around 2,100 guys, including the British, because the British were there. They took them out to their own camp later on. So we used to fraternized with the British guys. There were some British guys that had been old guys and had been in South America. Some of them spoke Spanish. So, we got along with those guys until they took them away,
So let me get this straight, Sam. Mm-hmm. You're a prisoner of the Chinese. In Korea, mm-hmm. speaking Spanish with British guys.
Well, because there were British guys there. There were British guys that were saved in Argentina. They were older guys, about in the 40s or 50s.
I don't think anybody's ever told me that story before. Yeah. Were there days where you felt yourself losing hope, or you wondered if you'd ever get out of there?
I guess there were a few days that probably, not lose hope, just wondered about it. What's going to happen to us and to me, with, mm-hmm. Especially before in 1952, the Chinese, because they had that propaganda, that statement that they said, that humanitarian treatment, they use that, I guess, to differentiate between the treatment the Koreans had given the other guys, the first prisoners of war. So they started bringing in 52 spring, they started bringing in sport equipment. First they brought a guitar, they were in our group. In our camp, there were some guys that knew how to play the guitar. So they brought a guitar, and then they brought an accordion later on, and later on they started bringing in baseball bats, and guys used to play baseball, mm-hmm. When they had a chance. And they brought basketball, and they had athletic activities, in the summertime, and especially in the summertime later on.
How big a difference did that make for you?
Well, I still had hope that maybe I started hearing about the armistice, that it raised our hopes, that we would maybe exchanged, someday.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask you, because I asked you if there were days where you started to lose hope. Mm-hmm. But I'm also curious where your hope came from. What were the things that kept you going or kept you believing that you could get out of there and come home and see your family again?
I think I was instilled to have faith in God, and I think that's a trick right there for me not to lose hope, not to give up, just take it as long as it came along, whatever we had to do. Whatever chore, whatever job, we had to just do it, I know one thing they did try, I don't know, it's well known that they tried to indoctrinate our GIs, but I saw one thing. They didn't succeed, I think, for two reasons. I think the two reasons were that the guys only had two things in their minds, the girls back home and the car. That's all the conversation there was, 99% of the time. I have this car, my car, and then And then, you know, by the girls also, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's I think it went in one ear out the other when they started talking. Because I tried, they tried to give, take us to some, like a playground. Mm-hmm. And then they start talking about it. And then the guys would pay attention.
You said indoctrinate. They're trying to brainwash you into seeing the world in a different way. Yeah. So what kinds of things were they talking about?
Well, I think they tried to say, about how they have achieved their new system or the way they live. A lot of guys just laughed at it. They didn't pay attention to that.
So it was like communist propaganda? Is that what you're talking about?
I think so. But the guys didn't pay attention to that. The main conversation of all the guys were just cars and more cars. Later on, because the Koreans use the system of the hemp, marijuana. Mm-hmm. They started them jets, especially the guys from LA, starting getting more involved with that. I think when we were over some villages, I used to use some machines, like big standing machines that were made of wood, and then like a lot of strings in it. And then I remember what I thought was, I used to see them weave, the machines that weave. You know, and what are they doing? And then the guy said, "Well, they're making clothes. They're making clothes. Their material looks like silk that is not clean. And their clothing material." And he said, "Why is that?" "Because that's hemp. That's that marijuana fiber." Mm-hmm. What they do, they wet the stalk and they peel it, and then they weave it. And there goes a shirt. But some GIs were very entrepreneurs. The Chinese started bringing soap and toothbrush and toothpaste and all that. And then they would take, when we go to get the wood or go out to the camp, they would meet the Korean people and started trading. So that was the kind of activity, yeah.
And you said, for all you guys, it was either the girl back home or the car.
Yeah.
What was it for you?
My family. Uh-huh. My family, yeah. That was my concern.
And was it cars they actually had or cars they wished they could have someday?
I think they were cars that they had, and that's what they talk about. And some probably thought of buying when they came out, if they came out.
2 years in captivity, what was the worst or most disgusting thing you had to eat?
Well, I got the story of the turnips. Okay. Yeah, turnips for 3 months, day in and day out, every morning and then the evening, turnip soup. And I still like turnips.
Sometimes that swings the other way. Yeah. So do you have any favorite turnip recipe you want to share with us?
No, not right now. Yeah. But that's another thing. See, I never was a finicky eater. I could eat everything. So it didn't bother me.
Well, I have had, some POWs tell me that one of the things that kept them going was they would dream about the food that they might eat if they ever got liberated. Was there a particular dish or restaurant or something that you thought about and said, "Boy, I can't wait"?
Well, there was one experience in one of the caves that I was sent into. It had been raining, and there was a puddle. So the other buddy from Puerto Rico, his name was Chevere. He had his own area. I dreamt that I was with my family, and my mother was, we were sitting at the table, and my mother had just sitting away from me, and then I would tell her, "Well, serve me." And she would serve me. She would reach to me. And I couldn't reach that dish that she was giving me. That was really a sad day for me. I started crying that day. Well, that was a sad day.
So this was a dream you had in that cave, and it was so real and palpable it made you cry.
Right. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. But other than that, to me it was tolerable. It was tolerable.
I'm just out of curiosity, that dish that your mother was trying to hand you that you couldn't take.
Frijoles. Beans.
Yeah.
That was my favorite, yeah. Yeah, that was it. But it was sad for me.
And, you told us how your family found out from your brother watching television. After that, did you ever get any mail or correspondence from your family?
I think I got only one letter. I kept it for a long time, and I lost it. I don't know how I lost it, but I kept it for a long time. Yes, I got one letter from my family.
It's time for our final break, but if you head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find an Associated Press photo from August 1953 that appeared in many a newspaper at the time. It shows an emotional Sam Banuelos being reunited with his parents after 2 years as a prisoner. We're going to hear about that special reunion through Sam's own memories in a moment. And just a reminder, if you happen to live near him in Central California, you can hang out with Sam and a whole bunch of his fellow veterans every Monday morning at the Clovis Veterans Memorial District in Clovis, California. They start their class promptly with the Pledge of Allegiance and the Star-Spangled Banner at 9:30. So get there around 9 and make some new friends. And stick around here on the radio for Sam's perspective on freedom as someone who's had to live without it. We'll also hear about at least one more close call we forgot to cover. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.